Good morning. Welcome to Talking About California, our series of discussions about California and about the people who live here, about their lives and their work. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning, our guest is Mike Davis. Many listeners will know that Mike is one of California's best-known writers. He's also a teacher, an historian, and a political activist. In 1996-1997, Mike was a Getty Scholar at the Getty Research Institute. He's received the MacArthur Fellowship. That was in 1998. He won the Lannan Literary Award for Nonfiction in 2007. Mike is now a distinguished professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. He's an editor of New Left Review. And not surprisingly, he's written far more than we can report on here, but among his books quickly are City of Quartz, Ecology of Fear, Magical Urbanism, Late Victorian Holocausts, Dead Cities, Planet of Slums. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, Cal. How are you?
I'm great, and it's really wonderful to have you on, Mike. I was wondering if we could begin, you've written about this, if we could begin with just a little bit about yourself. You're a native of Southern California, grown up and lived there. Maybe you could tell us a little about the history of Southern California. I know you've lived part of it and the transition that's taken place there in a generation or so.
Well, my parents hitchhiked out to the San Diego area during the middle of the Depression. And I was born in Fontana near San Bernardino, but I grew up in the East County of San Diego, the El Cajon area. Almost all the kids I grew up with, families had come out during the Depression or during the war. El Cajon was a blue-collar town. And it didn't have any real regulations or zoning in the early 50s. So some of my friends grew up in things like, Quonset huts that had been moved out into a field. But the extraordinary thing was that although we would have been seen certainly by the snobs who lived on Mount Helix or in San Diego as just a bunch of Okies or rednecks, we had exceptional educational opportunities. Everybody I grew up with, including the poorest, it's ended up being something like a skilled worker, firefighter, state park ranger, and everybody went back to school and got at least a community college degree, and we all did it for free. My entire education was free, not a single penny of tuition. And the single biggest difference between my generation, the very beginning of the baby boom, and kids for the last 10 or 15 years, is those opportunities no longer exist. No more free education, no investment on the same scale as during the Warner Brown years, and social infrastructure and services, and most of all, of course, not any of the kind of jobs that were available to us. When you graduated from high school in 1964, like I did, and if you weren't immediately drafted, I was called up but rejected as morally unsuitable. If you weren't immediately drafted, you could get up in the morning during the Johnson boom and ask yourself, do I want to be a truck driver, a longshoreman? Do I want to work in an auto plant factory? Do I want to build tires? Basically, all you had to do is, have a beating heart and a few muscles and go down to one of the major industrial corporations in Los Angeles and get a job. So I suppose if I could just condense this all into, one image, it's now possible for me to look back and just see the extraordinary opportunities that my generation and my friends, who were all blue-collar kids, had, and the destruction of those same opportunities in large part for the kids of today's immigrants.
Okay, and what about destruction? I mean, could you just say a word about what you mean by that and how it's happened?
Well, I mean, if you look at Southern California, of course, when I came out of high school, the biggest industry was the aircraft industry and the aerospace industry, employed over 500,000 people. There was another probably 250,000 people in Southern California who worked in auto tire constructions, you know, steel and aluminum. And almost all of that, of course, has disappeared. And the kind of entire skilled working class strata of Southern California society no longer exists in the way that it did even, you know, 25 or 30 years ago. And you have this incredible polarized employment structure where at the bottom you have people, at least 40% of the population of Southern California, who's struggling to get by on minimum wage jobs or even off even off the radar screen entirely in the black economy. Families get by because so many of the family members work and pool the resources. That's particularly true of the students I have at UC Riverside, where we have the only student body actually looks like the population of California. And we have lots of first-generation college kids, particularly Latinos. And almost universally, if you talk to these kids, their families not only have worked hard, but they have saved and combined these incomes to build a stairway that otherwise wouldn't have been possible, given the polarization of the labor markets, to get their kids into college. And of course, now the question is, they will graduate into what? I've been talking to my students a lot in the last year, and it's quite incredible how many cases one of their parents has lost a long-term job, how many cases their house has been foreclosed, or under the, you know, the brink of foreclosure.
Mike, I mean, I can imagine you teaching all sorts of subjects, but since you've raised the issue here, would you mind telling me about teaching creative writing and what you're working on there, and a little, you know, how you are relating to the students that you've just described?
Well, teaching is something I just fell into because the things I really wanted to do in life, I couldn't get a job at, or I was a failure at. And creative writing is something I never expected to teach. But the program at Riverside, which is the only program that includes an undergraduate degree, creative writing, is quite remarkable. I have wonderful colleagues. This is a program which in a way has focused on producing writers out of kids from the working class backgrounds of inland California, not just the Inland Empire of Southern California, but kids from the Central Valley, kids from the Imperial Valley. So it's probably unlike almost any other creative writing program I can think of in that sense. And I teach nonfiction, and I must say the biggest surprise to me, because I came to this, I'd never taken a writing class, I had no idea what teaching writing meant, but the biggest surprise was that nonfiction has come to me in almost exclusively memoir. And the problem is, of course, that not many people, 23 or 24 years old, have really had the life experiences, the events that quite qualify as memoir. But this is, this is the contour of the, you know, the literary scene today. This is what nonfiction has come to mean. Journalism, just by the economic crunch and the collapse of newspapers and syndication of weekly newspapers doesn't offer much of a career, you know, to anybody. So my students are basically writing about their lives. In some cases, have had very harrowing and drastic lives. In some cases, not. It's a, I suppose it's part of the fabric, and I'm talking now about graduate students, not my undergraduates, but I suppose it's part of the fabric of this society that has gone from being therapeutic to now almost totally confessional.
Confessional. Could you tell me a bit about what you mean by that?
Well, you know, sometime in, I don't know, the 60s or 70s, the way that ordinary people, like folks in my family, begin to talk about their lives and relationship became increasingly therapeutic based on concepts from pop psychology or kind of watered-down psychoanalysis. That's when we discovered codependency and all kinds of other oppressive, restraining relationships in our life. But in the last decade, I think we've gone a lot farther than this, and everyone virtually now confesses their stories, their families, deepest secrets and melodramas. And for somebody of my age and background, I find this quite harrowing. I grew up with people who had, you know, lots of family violence and things like that going on, but it was the test of your character that you got over that and you became a person in spite of it. And above all, you never talked about it. You never, you know, cried or talked about how bad you had it, because there's always some kid sitting next to you in school who had it worse. Now, my, like, working-class Latino undergraduates, by and large, don't do this, but my graduate students and most of the kind of middle-class students I've met, I mean, they're putting their entire lives on the Internet, and they're telling family secrets, and this is erosion, I believe, is something, you know, deeply important and valuable. Ideas about honor and character, which are now virtually extinct, I think, in our society.
Wow. Mike, you're sort of the historian of Southern California, at least to many of us, and more than that, but and especially of Los Angeles. And I think in your career, you've spent a lot of time writing urban history, and but a different kind of urban history. The word ecology appears in much of your work. One of your great books is Ecology of Fear. Could you tell us a bit about your interest in urban history, and then when and how, or urban and ecological came together?
Well, I came to this inadvertently. My real interest, and the reason I went back to college, aside from losing a job I very much liked, driving a truck, was to study economics, political economy, with the hope of maybe finding a job with one of the unions. But that never proved possible at the time, and I ended up in England working for the New Left Review and being very homesick. And I started thinking a lot about how you could possibly explain Southern California in terms of the conceptions that seemed to be easy to apply to other countries, other cities in the world. And this is probably a continuation of a almost infantile dialogue from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I had these fantasies about trying to explain how great America was and how good it was to some Russian kid. I used to rehearse this all the time in my mind, this kind of patriotic description. But in truth, I had no handle at all on explaining Southern California. What I knew about Southern California was I had a job as a driver, bus driver for these Gray Line tours, and I went out and read Perry McWilliams to be able to have something to tell the tourists. But it really took exile. It took being, you know, far away in another country that I could begin to see how you might tell the story of Southern California and how it would differ from other histories, first of all, to the extent that its images, its presentation of itself, its mythologies become part of its material reality. So rather than just starting off with discussing the industrial foundations or economic foundations, I had to start off with the mythologies and the myth makers in Southern California. I came to ecology before I left England because I read this incredible book by the fire historian Stephen Pine, Social History of Wildfire in America, and it just one of the most exciting books I'd ever read, and it opened up all kinds of new vistas for me. So I conceived the project, and this is right after the Rodney King riots, right after the floods, just before the last big earthquake in Los Angeles in 94. Writing this book, Ecology Fear, whose basic theme was that Southern Californians, by and large, have so misunderstood the nature they live in and the history of that nature that it turns what are otherwise ordinary events, natural earthquake, brush fires, and so on, into these apocalyptic tremors and fears, and leads to profound confusion between the natural and the social. The social is seen in natural terms, like street gangs as, you know, feral packs, while mountain lions get compared to street gangsters. This is actually true, and I wanted to sort out the origins and development of this confusion, this set of fears. And ironically, the book became known for exactly the opposite of the thesis I was trying to portray. I was critiquing the image of Los Angeles as apocalypse. I was trying to show how in these dioramas of LA's destruction, increasingly there was essentially a racist or white supremacist plot of some kind or another. But the book was received very much in the opposite, being a kind of collection of tales, one more extreme than the other, about the end of Los Angeles. But the declared purpose of the book was quite the opposite.
Okay, and here we are with another big question that you were not... I'm not exactly following my notes here, but I want to follow your discussion. Can we say something about what you mean by white supremacy and maybe bring us up to date? Things are changing a lot, the mayor and so forth. What's your take on that, since that's...
Well, first of all, if you read the science fiction that involves the destruction of Los Angeles, it starts at the beginning with Chinese and then Japanese invasions, the Yellow Peril. If you look at post-war science fiction, both as novels and as films, increasingly it becomes a kind of white survivalism. There's a novel, for instance, by Larry Niven, who's a very famous sci-fi writer. I forget the name of it. Lucifer's Hammer, maybe, where the novel's about white survivalism, And instead of zombies like in so many other post-apocalyptic scenarios, it's dangerous blacks and Latinos. This stuff now saturates depictions of the end of Los Angeles. And if you see it in film, you have to ask yourself, why do people take such pleasure in watching Hollywood, watching L.A. Be destroyed, when they seldom take the same kind of pleasure in disaster fiction that involves, say, London or New York City? And one reason, of course, is that they see the city already as an alien thing because it's, you know, a majority city of color, of immigrants. So a lot of their social fears, racial fears, have ended up being expressed in images of Los Angeles dying. One great exception to that, of course, being the Alien Nation series, which I don't know if anybody remembers, but where poor slaves from another planet are suddenly, fall to Earth and become a lower caste, largely in Southern California. And I think that series probably had an very explicitly, anti-racist ethics to it. But apart from that, so much of the concern with disaster is if it's not a conscious racial reaction, it has that, implicit, meaning. And again, rests on a fundamental confusion between nature and society, between social fears and environmental ignorance.
This is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and this morning we're very happy to be talking with Mike Davis, the writer, activist, historian, author of many books and many, many articles. We've been talking a bit about Los Angeles and one of his books, The Ecology of Fear. Another book, is there anything that could be added to this discussion from your work on City of Quartz?
City of Quartz is the book I referred to first as this search to find a kind of epistemology or narrative strategy for Los Angeles. And it couldn't be, a simple social history. It couldn't be something like Victorian Edinburgh or Berlin under, the Weimar Republic, because it had to account for the fact that real estate industry and Hollywood have played such a large role shaping the image and mythologies of the region, but at the same time they've set back and become material forces, which sometimes have reinforced the environmental misunderstanding I talk about. The inability to understand, Mediterranean nature in its most normal state. City Quartz also focused on, for instance, the role of religion in Southern California, above all the Catholic Church and the Catholic Archdiocese. It looked at gangs, and it looked at homeowners associations. It's a white middle-class riot. And when I wrote the book, was at the moment that these two things were intersecting. The Operation Hammer, Gerald Gates, police chief LA's huge dragnet against minority youth, mass arrests, mass bookings. It was clear it was driving the city to some kind of precipice, but at the same time, you had this rebellion of scores, even several hundred homeowners associations against growth, against densification, desperately trying to preserve the completely suburban character of their neighborhoods and their home values. So I was interested in how these two otherwise seemingly very distant or unrelated phenomena could be seen as parts of a larger process. And that larger process was the globalization of the economy in Southern California.
On the same subject, I guess, of urban...
Can't hear you at all, I'm afraid.
Sorry. Urban issues and ecological issues, I noticed, and it seems quite rightly, that you've been given credit for helping us to understand events like, say, Katrina in New Orleans, and you wrote about that. And maybe we could talk about, you could talk about that and go to one more city, and then we could shift our focus. Did you write about Katrina? Was that of interest to you?
Well, I had been to New Orleans couple of times before Katrina, and my wife and I had even considered moving there, but above all, I had a good friend, a young architect, who's from the Cajun country, but most of his family live in New Orleans, and right after Katrina, I think it was the, it was 9 or 10 days after the storm began, we arrived in New Orleans when it was still supposedly, you know, occupied by the police and empty of people. And within a few days, it became clear that some of the most important stories just weren't being told at all. The most important of these, which was later developed by a brilliant young journalist for The Nation and has now become part of the subplot of the this HBO series in New Orleans, of course, was the, you know, the murder, you know, a large number of murders of ordinary people by the New Orleans Police Department. But the thing we were focused on is that people may recall the Lower Ninth Ward, which was almost totally destroyed by Katrina, was totally destroyed. Several hundred people lost their lives there. Well, there was an enormous barge, a block long, huge barge, river barge, which had been catapulted through the flood wall to the Lower Ninth Ward off a canal that connects the Mississippi to Lake Pontchartrain. And it was just the most enormous object in this devastated landscape. And you looked at it and you immediately knew that it had been hurled through the flood wall, landed, pummeled right into an apartment building, which totally destroyed. So who owned the barge, and why was the hurricane coming? Was it able to break loose and cause this devastation? This, of course, is one amongst the many causes, above all the shoddy, probably even criminal construction of the outlet canals that produced by the Army Corps of Engineers that produced, you know, the larger flooding in the city. And from these kind of what I'd consider normal news stories, then I moved on to writing about what I think is the, you know, the major narrative, the master narrative of all, which is long before Katrina, the city of Leeds have been obsessed with the question of how to reduce the poor black population of New Orleans, particularly the people in the housing projects. And, of course, Katrina was instant urban renewal. It solved that problem. And, of course, a very large minority of New Orleans' African-American population, including virtually all the public housing projects, haven't come back to the city. Those folks are still in Texas or Atlanta or somewhere else. So this was mission accomplished for the elites. And New Orleans has extremely well-defined you know, famous business elites. And along with that, of course, it completely altered the politics of Louisiana. Louisiana was unique in the South because it had this coalition built by Huey Long and his brother that allied black voters, and the Longs fought very hard to keep blacks enfranchised in Louisiana between black voters and Catholic voters, French-speaking people of southern Louisiana, Cajuns and so on. But by the time Katrina came, the margin of power in the whole state was the black majority in New Orleans. And the deliberate ethnic cleansing of New Orleans, not only the failure just to rehouse people, but the destruction of public housing projects that were perfectly intact and not even, you know, with the most minor damage from the hurricane, it's changed the whole balance of power in the state. And now Louisiana is like Alabama or its neighbor Mississippi. There's now, a small white majority, and it's really had devastating impact on Louisiana politics. And, of course, you could attribute what I'm saying to some kind of, a rational conspiracy theory, but not more than conspiracy theory. But everything I've just said, was said at the time or has been said since by members of the city elites or local politicians. There wasn't much even duplicity about what was going on. Katrina was an opportunity which the elites took to expel poor working-class black people, keep them out of the city, and then both redesign the city to promote the highest values to their own property while Republican majority redesigned state politics.
So is this disaster capitalism, Naomi Klein's thesis, is that something that's a useful way of thinking about these crises?
Well, I'm not sure. I must confess, I've not read the famous book you're alluding to by Naomi Klein, so I'm not even actually sure what her thesis is. No, this was ethnic cleansing in Louisiana. And it not only happened in Louisiana, it happened a slightly different way in Mississippi, where I was in Mississippi as well. It was a few weeks after Katrina, and it was really the most unbelievable. It was like nuclear destruction. There were foundations and nothing more left of whole towns. But in Mississippi, the casinos were rebuilt. The expensive summer homes or winter homes, as the case may be, if people were rebuilt. But thousands of working-class Mississippians, the ones who, work in the casinos and beach resorts, their homes weren't rebuilt, and they were treated just scandalously in terms of compensation and relief. So they now may commute 50 to 100 miles to work on the Gulf Coast. And I think you'll see this in further disasters in the United States. Rather than leading to some withdrawal from hazardous and dangerous terrains, it'll lead more toward redesigning the sociology and the real estate values of the area. I think this is probably what's going on right now in New York in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy. And this is just old-fashioned, nitty-gritty class racial politics.
Well, before we leave urban studies, could you tell us a word about your book, Planet of Slums?
Well, 10 10 years ago, the United Nations published a book, United Nations Habitat, the United Nations agency that deals with urban issues, published a book called The Challenge of Slums. And, of course, the UN publishes thousands, if not tens of thousands of pages every year. But this city was unique because it used a methodology, survey methodology about people's living conditions and incomes that had never been applied on a global scale before. It's a methodology worked out at the World Bank, and then enlisted 60 top urban scholars from across the world to write case studies of almost as many cities. And the portrait it presented was, you know, actually quite staggering. I think far beyond even the worst-case scenarios of pessimistic Marxists like myself. And the study concluded that 1 billion people lived in slums. Now, that's larger than the population of the Earth when Dickens started writing about slum dwellers in London. And I wanted to draw attention to this enormously important research, but I also wanted to go back and look at the footnotes and sources. So I contrived this project of reading in English and French, the only other language I can read, reading in English and French basically everything I could find on urban housing, informal employment, fundamental human services, and so on. It's been written in the last 30 years. And this is the one thing I'm actually quite good at, is kind of vacuuming up, you know, research data. And most of this was new to me, I must confess. But it soon emerged that if you look at this literature and you look at the different research communities involved, two things have become virtually consensus, or at least the majority views. And one is that informal housing, the slums, that frontier has closed now. The ability of a group of poor people, for instance, to take some flat land at the edge of the city, build the shanty town, fight off the government, and eventually get that normalized and maybe even get title to the land, that isn't happening anymore. In many cities, the overwhelming majority of people who live in slums are actually renters, and private markets of different kinds have replaced the traditional strategy of occupation. Now, the places where people squat are simply places far too dangerous, hazardous, to be able to be sold on the market. And the second conclusion in the literature was that informal employment, street vending, rag picking, running shebeens out of your house, being a day worker, casual labor, being a rickshaw walla, these jobs had been celebrated as the miracle of the developing world, that poor people and new immigrants to the city were creating their own housing, their own jobs, without state aid, and in cities where actually the formal sector of employment was shrinking. But in fact, the overwhelming literature is that there aren't so many of these niches available to poor people. And what you find in city after city is a kind of super Darwinian competition, both for informal housing, but especially informal jobs. And this has led, in many cases, to the emergence of ethnic or linguistic or some kind of identity politic militias or political machines who are able to exclude one group of people in order to give a slight advantage to their own group, but in a structural context of where there's simply too many people living informally. And by informal, we'd call it unemployment here, but since people in most developing world don't have unemployment insurance, they have to survive somehow. So this is the sector of work that they created. So the ability, in other words, of poor urban dwellers, population is rapidly increasing, to just improvise lives for themselves in the city has come to the edge of a cliff in my view, and there's little flexibility left. Yet if you look at some of the best-selling books now, and particularly written by kind of neoconservatives about urbanism and development, they're all saying, well, poor people simply need to come to the cities. It's better than the countryside, and they'll cope somehow. They'll ultimately be successes. And I don't believe that scenario at all, and I don't think it's reflected in, a couple of thousand articles that I ended up skimming or reading for Planet of Slums.
And an alternative in your mind to coming to the city?
Well, the alternatives, I think, are in general very clear. First of all, is to stabilize existence in the countryside, where still the majority of the poor live. This is still a paramount issue in the world, the question of agrarian reform and decent livelihoods for people in the countryside, which are being threatened from all directions, whether by agricultural multinationals, by in some cases, like in China, just this immense expansion of city areas, gobbling up, rural land, price systems, and so on, that completely disadvantage family farmers. The starting point is to reject this idea that you have to kind of just give up on the countryside and let market forces expel everybody, to the city. And the second point, of course, is that the state in some form has to come in back into the picture, in the provision of housings and jobs and adequate schools. And ultimately, that's a question of the redistribution of wealth. And it's quite amazing how ubiquitous it is in the developing world for the middle classes to avoid income or land taxation almost of any kind. Taxation usually is a taxation of basic commodities. It's use of sales taxes. And that is a very important issue in the class struggle. But what we've seen so far in kind of renaissance of the populist left in Latin America, it's been that parties of the left have gone to the verge of redistributing wealth, but they've not crossed it. In both the case of Brazil and Venezuela, the famous social programs, have been undertaken and been largely financed by commodity export booms. But the solution to the problem of slums lays in stabilizing and empowering the life of farm workers and farmers in the countryside, and of confiscating a substantial part of the unearned wealth of the middle classes or upper middle classes. And obviously, this is difficult to imagine in any realistic context without social violence, probably on a large scale.
This is KZYX. Our program is talking about California. Our guest this morning is Mike Davis. Mike is the author of many books. We've been talking about several of them this morning, including his widely read book, The Planet of Slums. Could we go back to California? And maybe I read a very interesting article that you wrote about the election, which had to do with demographic change and the implications of demographic change. And you live now in San Diego, not so far from the border. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your experience with that issue.
Well, the first writing I did on the subject of political demographics was actually a long time ago, writing about Southeast Los Angeles County, the industrial blue-collar suburbs on both sides of the Alameda Corridor, the major border that connects downtown to the harbor. And you had a period, in some cases, of 20 years, actually in a few in cases, 30 years, where you had a Latino demographic majority, but the electorate remained majority white, both because Latinos were younger, but especially because people weren't citizens, didn't have access to franchise. And in this period, in city after city, you had a group of good old boys relying on white politicians, relying on geriatric vote of scared remaining white people, usually old, who were primarily interested in having as much police as possible, and they, in a way, wrecked the future of these cities. Places like Bell and Bell Gardens, Cudahy, Huntington Park, the Southgate, Compton, although that's a more, you know, complex story. So when finally the Latino political majorities, electoral majorities, arose, and there was a lot of excitement and movement about what that might mean, they found basically that city government consisted of paying the police and paying off the long-term debts for insane redevelopment projects that the good old boys had put into place during their period. And this has led, I think, to a lot of disillusionment at the base of Los Angeles and Southern California electoral politics, at least the electoral politics of the working poor. And a similar issue I attempted to raise in piece I recently wrote, kind of an overlong, fairly tedious analysis of Obama's reelection, which is, of course, that while the white majority has finally had its day on a national scale, at least the first instance of this in the in the election, nothing the Democrats offer will provide the new voters with the kind of opportunities I was talking about earlier, that my generation of working class kids of immigrants from the Southwest and in the Midwest had, thanks to the CIO, thanks to liberal Democrats, and thanks to progressive Republicans for that matter. I mean, the Democrats right now in Sacramento are so far to the right of, for instance, Earl Warren, the progressive Republican governor of California, who became, of course, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So there's a fundamental tension or contradiction between the hopes and visions that drive people to participate in politics and, to reelect Barack Obama. The fundamental contradiction between that and the actual program of the Democratic Party, which has more to do with how to administer austerity than how to prevent it. And, one can speculate what will emerge out of this contradiction. Will it be demoralization, like the voter demoralization of the kind that I've described that's already happened in L.A.'s majority Latino communities? Does this create a space for progressive Democrats are elected the Democratic Party, or doesn't ensure that the most reactionary wing of the Republican Party in many places, in many states, will not be easily deposed by mere demography.
Right. Mike, you, the first thing I read, I think, of yours was a collection called Prisoners of the American Dream sometime in back. You write about the working class. Working class, your vocabulary is filled with the language of class, but you're not a typical labor historian. Could you say something about your understanding of class, especially in the sense of your urban analysis?
Well, the book opens, I think it's 1984 elections, or 86, can't even remember, with a bunch of working class guys sitting on bar stools instead of voting. And it asks the question, just straightforwardly, you know, why does the majority of the American working class abstain most of the time from going to the poll and not exercising the rights of suffrage? And then that led into a very kind of complicated theory of American labor history. It's, I think, obvious to anybody who knows the history of American workers and of the American lot that the key group, again and again historically, with the brief exception at the beginning of the 20th century, the key constituency of the lot, both the left of the labor movement and the political lot, have always been immigrants, starting with German and Czech immigrants in the 1880s, and then Jews and Italians, Finns after them, today immigrants from Mexico and Central America, because they're the ones who've conducted the most heroic journeys to get to the country and its opportunities in the first place, and they're the ones most forcibly disillusioned by the realities they find, whether discrimination or simply the fact that, you know, the jobs they imagine would be there, the sources of family upward mobility simply don't exist. And this has happened time and time again, of course, in American history. And rather than just being, you know, one stage in 19th century, early 20th century, I agree this is almost a permanent underlying a crisis. And that the problem, of course, strategically, has always been how to build a bridge from radicalized immigrants, many of whom are the carriers of radical traditions and radical politics to begin with, how to build a bridge between them and the native working class in this country. And this is just the strategic dilemma that every generation of the left has had to face.
Okay, and maybe to finish up and tie some of these...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you at all.
Maybe to finish up, Mike, and tie some of these issues together, I mentioned at the beginning that I've seen you describe yourself as an old-fashioned socialist, and maybe you could tell us what you mean by that. Old-fashioned doesn't have to be the main focus. We don't hear much about socialism anymore, new or old, and we don't hear much about Marxism anymore, new or old. And you're also described as an environmental Marxist, Mike. Could you tell us give us a little bit of information about these sort of definitions? And
well, to be precise, I wouldn't call myself a Marxist, obviously much influenced by Marx, but also by other traditions of the left, particularly anarchist thinkers as well. So when people ask me what I am politically, I try and explain to them that Marxism is not a political identity. It's an intellectual or ideological affiliation. But that I'm a socialist in the old-fashioned sense that Billy Graham is a Baptist, which is, I believe, in the that labor should rule the earth and in the democratic social ownership of the means of production, and that I believe in struggles of the present. The role of socialists is first to be the best builders and honest participants in those struggles, but secondly, to always attempt to raise the question of property and economic power. I mean, the Occupy movement, for instance, enabled a great focus for a period on the question of economic inequality. But I don't actually ever remember anybody saying that the bank should become public utilities, or that the question of power is ultimately even more important than the question of the distribution of income. It has to become a matter of public ownership, and public ownership, of course, has to involve a new and more advanced form of democracy. Not simply, state or bureaucratic ownership. I believe that the two driving forces of American history, ones that have brought significant change, revolutionary democratic struggle of people of color and the mass struggle of workers, not so much for wages or social benefits, but as in the case of the CIO in the 30s, questions about power in the workplace and dignity in the workplace, questions that have become are now as salient today as they were in the turn, the turn of the century. And in a sense, that's what I believe in. In short, talk theory and talk social historical analysis, but even if you erase the whole historical experience of the left, you would still come to these fundamental questions. You know, how do you distribute and create equality without owning socially and democratically the large-scale means of production? It's still the essential question.
Okay, and I think that every one of your writings, Mike, will push people to think about those questions and to think about them more deeply than they probably have done before. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. Our program is talking about California. This morning we've been talking to the writer, activist, historian, teacher, Mike Davis. We've been talking about his own work, including a number of his books. I should recommend any of them: Ecology of Fear, City of Quartz, Planet of Slums, No One is Illegal. Mike, thanks very much for coming on the radio with us. I'm sure our listeners will have gotten a good deal out of it. And listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back next week at the same time. Good morning. Okay, Mike, many thanks again. Appreciate it.
Of course, Cal.
Best to you and your family. Always love reading what you write.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.